Welcome to Protecting Project Pulp, part of the District of Wonders Network, featuring Starship Sofa, Tales to Terrify, and Crime City Central. Everyone has a story in the District of Wonders. Come and find yours. Hello, thrill seekers, genre renegades, and connoisseurs of vintage pulpy goodness. And welcome to Issue 2 of Protecting Project Pulp, the podcast dedicated to unleashing epic tales from the glory days of pulp fiction upon an eager audience hungry for adventure. That would be you. I'm your host, Dave Robison. Have you noticed there's an awful lot of signal chatter about the new pulp? Maybe I'm just sensitive to it, having become a pulp junkie in recent months, but I found no less than 5 articles, blogs, and podcasts all addressing the new pulp, and all of them with links to even more content. And some are scholarly inquiries into the merit or relevance of the term. Others are more ardent and impassioned advocates of this new chapter in the literary genre canon. In fact, on a recent showcase episode of the Roundtable podcast, crime fiction author Seth Harwood claimed that the low cost of production and distribution had set the stage for, the new pulp. Google it. You'll find all that and more. Now, I know you're eager for today's story, and I am too, for that matter. So I'm not going to take up a lot of our precious time together with these speculations, but we'll be revisiting this topic in future episodes, because it's important. Hey, I heard that. Come on, Dave, important. This is fun, it's entertaining, it's nostalgic. But important? You bet it is, and I'll tell you why. Because the last time conditions were right for a pulp fiction market, it awakened giants like H.P. Lovecraft, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Edgar Rice Burroughs, Raymond Chandler, John D. MacDonald, and Ray Bradbury. The face of genre fiction was changed forever, and if we are in the midst of a new pulp renaissance, then who knows what new titans will rise from the digital froth. But for now we cast our ears back in time to 1958, to be precise. Flipping through the pages of Galaxy magazine, you'd stumble across a hilarious sci-fi tale by another of those giants I was referring to, Fritz Leiber. Now, his birth on Christmas Eve 1910 was like a prophecy because, friends, he was indeed a gift to the world of sci-fi, fantasy, and horror. Many claimed that he was one of the fathers of sword and sorcery for his popular Fofford and Greymouser tales. Leiber filled 7 tomes over 50 years with the tales of the broad-thewed barbarian and his lithe and cunning companion, who were based on Leiber himself and his friend Harry Fisher. Now, Leiber led a turbulent life. He corresponded with H.P. Lovecraft. He struggled with depression and alcoholism, acted in a handful of movies, and had some of his works adapted for film. He was a poet, a playwright, an expert chess player, and a champion fencer. Awarded multiple Hugo, Nebula, Derleth, Lovecraft, and World Fantasy Awards, he also received the Grand Master of Fantasy, the World Fantasy Award for Lifetime Achievement, the Bram Stoker Lifetime Achievement Award, and the Grand Master Nebula Award. Now, the tale we have for you today is Bread Overhead, one of his highly entertaining and satirical pieces that showcases not only the scope of his imagination, but the clarity with which he applied it to contemporary society. The story is read for us today by Mike Wood, a performer of many talents. He's a Canadian living in London, and he's a comedian who's been making people laugh since 1994. He's performed his dry, offbeat humor in every province in Canada and 13 different countries around the world. He's also a mining engineer. You can learn more about this entertaining chap at www.mikewood.ca or follow him on Twitter at funnyonceaday. So get out a loaf of bread, make a sandwich, and enjoy Bread Overhead by the mighty Fritz Leiber.
As a blisteringly hot but guaranteed weather-controlled future summer day dawned on the Mississippi Valley, the walking mills of Puffy Products, Spike to Loaf in one operation, began to tread delicately on their centipede legs across the wheat fields of Kansas. The walking mills resembled fat metal serpents, rather larger than those Chinese paper dragons animated by files of men in procession. Sensory robot devices in their noses informed them that the waiting wheat had reached ripe perfection. As they advanced, their heads swung lazily from side to side, very much like snakes gobbling the yellow grain. In their throats it was threshed, the chaff bundled and burped aside for pickup by the crawl trucks of a chemical corporation, the kernels quick-dried and blown along into the mighty chests of the machines. There the tireless mills ground the kernels to flour, which was instantly sifted, the bran being packaged and dropped like the chaff for pickup. A cluster of tanks which gave the metal serpents a decidedly humpbacked appearance added water, shortening, salt, and other ingredients, some named and some not. The dough was at the same time infused with gas from a tank conspicuously labeled carbon dioxide. "No yeast creatures in your bread!" Thus instantly risen, the dough was clipped into loaves and shot into radionic ovens forming the midsections of the metal serpents. There the bread was baked in a matter of seconds, a fierce heat front browning the crusts and the piping hot loaves sealed in transparent plastic bearing the proud Puffy Loaf emblem, two cherubs circling a floating loaf, and ejected onto the delivery platform at each serpent's rear end, where a cluster of pickup machines like hungry piglets snatched at the loaves with hygienic claws. A few loaves would be hurried off for the day's consumption, the majority stored for winter in strategically located mammoth deep freezes. But now, behold a wonder! As loaves began to appear on the delivery platform of the first walking mill to get into action, they did not linger on the conveyor belt, but rose gently into the air and slowly traveled off downwind across the hot, rippling fields. The robot claws of the pickup machines clutched in vain and, not noticing the difference, proceeded carefully to stack emptiness tier by tier. One errant loaf, rising more sluggishly than its fellows, was snagged by a thrusting claw. The machine paused, clumsily wiped off the injured loaf, set it aside where it bobbed on one corner, unable to take off again, and went back to the work of storing nothingness. A flock of crows rose from the trees of a nearby shelter belt as the flight of loaves approached. The crows swooped to investigate and then suddenly scattered, screeching in panic. The helicopter of a hangoverish Sunday traveler bound for Wichita shied very similarly from the brown flyers and did not return for a second look. A black-haired housewife spied them over her back fence, crossed herself, and grabbed her walkie-talkie from the laundry basket. Seconds later, the yawning correspondent of a regional newspaper was jotting down the lead of a humorous news story which, recalling the old flying saucer scares, stated that now apparently bread was to be included in the mad aerial tea party. The congregation of an open-walled country church, standing up to recite that most familiar of Christian prayers, had just reached the petition for daily sustenance, when a sub-flight of loaves, either forced down by a vagrant wind or lacking the natural buoyancy of the rest, came coasting silently as the sunbeams between the graceful pillars at the altar end of the building. Meanwhile, the main flight, now augmented by the bread flocks from scores and hundreds of walking mills that had started work a little later, mounted slowly and majestically into the cirrus-flecked upper air where a steady wind was blowing strongly toward the east. About 1,000 miles farther on in that direction, where a cluster of stratosphere-tickling towers marked the location of the metropolis of New York, a tender scene was being enacted in the pressurized penthouse managerial suite of Puffy Products. Megera Winterly, secretary in chief to the managerial board and referred to by her underlings as the blonde icicle, was dealing with the advances of Roger Racehorse Snedden, assistant secretary to the board and often indistinguishable from any passing office boy. "Why don't you jump out the window, Roger, remembering to shut the airlock after you?" the Golden Glacier said in tones not unkind. "When are your high-strung, thoroughbred nerves going to accept the fact that I would never consider marriage with a business inferior? You have about as much chance as a starving Ukrainian kulak now that Moscow's clapped on the interdict." Roger's voice was calm, although his eyes were feverishly bright as he replied, "A lot of things are going to be different around here, Meg, as soon as the board is forced to admit that only my quick thinking made it possible to bring the name of Puffyloaf in front of the whole world." "Puffyloaf could do with a little of that," the business girl observed judiciously. "The way sales have been plummeting, it won't be long before the government deeds our desks to the managers of Fairy Bread and asks us to take the big jump." "But just where does your quick thinking come into this, Mr. Snedden? You can't be referring to the helium. That was Rose Thinker's brainwave." She studied him suspiciously. "You've birthed another promotional bumble, Roger. I can see it in your eyes. I only hope it's not as big a one as when you put the Martian ambassador on 3D and he thanked you profusely for the gross of puffy loaves, assuring you that he'd never slept on a softer mattress in all his life on two planets." "Listen to me, Meg. Today, yes, today, you're going to see the board eating out of my hand." "Ha! I guarantee you won't have any fingers left. You're bold enough now, but when Mr. Grice and those two big machines come through that door..." "Now wait a minute, Meg. Hush! They're coming now." Roger leaped 3 feet in the air, but managed to land without a sound and edged toward his stool. Through the dilating iris of the door strode Phineas T. Grice, flanked by Rose Thinker and Tin Philosopher. The man approached the conference table in the center of the room with measured pace and gravely expressionless face. The rose-tinted machine on his left did a couple of impulsive pirouettes on the way and twittered a greeting to Meg and Roger. The other machine quietly took the third of the high seats and lifted a claw at Meg, who now occupied a stool twice the height of Roger's. "Miss Winterly, please, our theme." The blonde icicle's face thawed into a little girl smile as she chanted bubblingly, "Made up of tiny wheaten motes and reinforced with sturdy oats, it rises through the air and floats, the bread on which all Terra dotes." "Thank you, Miss Winterly," said Tin Philosopher. "Though a purely figurative statement, that bit about rising through the air always gets me here." He rapped his midsection, which gave off a high musical clang. "Ladies," he inclined his photocells towards Rose Thinker and Meg, "and gentlemen, this is a historic occasion in Old Puffy's long history, the inauguration of the helium-filled loaf, so light it almost floats away, in which that inert and heaven-aspiring gas replaces old-fashioned carbon dioxide. Later, there will be kudos for Rose Thinker, whose bright relays genius sparked the idea, and also for Roger Snedden, who took care of the details. And by the by, Racehorse, that was a brilliant piece of work getting the helium out of the government. They've been pretty stuffy lately about their monopoly. But first I want to throw wide the casement in your minds that opens on the long view of things." Rose Thinker spun twice in her chair and opened her photocells wide. Tin Philosopher coughed to limber up the diaphragm of his speaker and continued, "Ever since the first cave wife boasted to her next-den neighbor about the superior paleness and fluffiness of her tortillas, mankind has sought lighter, whiter bread. Indeed, thinkers wiser than myself have equated the whole upward course of culture with this poignant quest. Yeast was a wonderful discovery for its primitive day. Sifting the bran and wheat germ from the flour was an even more important advance. Early bleaching and preserving chemicals played their humble parts. For a while, barbarous faddists, blind to the deeply spiritual nature of bread, which is recognized by all great religions, held back our march toward perfection with their hair-splitting insistence on the vitamin content of the wheat germ. But their case collapsed when tasteless, colorless substitutes were triumphantly synthesized and introduced into the loaf, which, for flawless purity, unequaled airiness, and sheer intangible goodness, was rapidly becoming mankind's supreme gustatory experience." "I wonder what the stuff tastes like," Rose Thinker said out of a clear sky. "I wonder what taste tastes like," Tin Philosopher echoed dreamily. Recovering himself, he continued, "Then, early in the 21st century, came the epical researches of Everett Whitehead, Puffyloaf chemist. culminating in his paper, The Structural Bubble in Cereal Masses, and making possible the baking of airtight bread 20 times stronger for its weight than steel, and of a lightness that would have been incredible even to the advanced chemist bakers of the 20th century. A lightness so great that besides forming the backbone of our own promotion, it has forever since been capitalized on by our conscienceless competitors, Fairy Bread, with their enduring slogan, It Makes Ghost Toast. That's a beaut, all right, that ecto-dough blurb, Rose Thinker admitted, bugging her photocells sadly. Wait a sec, what about, There'll be bread overhead when you're dead, it is said. Phineas T. Gryce wrinkled his nostrils at the pink machine as if he smelled her insulation smoldering. He said mildly, a somewhat unhappy jingle, Rose, referring as it does to the end of the customer as consumer. Moreover, we shouldn't overplay the figurative rises through the air angle. What inspired you? She shrugged. I don't know. Oh, yes, I do. I was remembering one of the workers' songs we machines used to chant during the big strike. Work and pray, live on hay. You'll get pie in the sky when you die. It's a lie. I don't know why we chanted it, she added. We didn't want pie, or hay for that matter. And machines don't pray, except Tibetan prayer wheels. Phineas T. Gryce shook his head. Labor relations are another topic we should stay far away from. However, dear Rose, I'm glad you keep trying to out-jingle those dirty crooks at Fairy Bread. He scowled, turning back his attention to Tin Philosopher. I get whopping mad, old machine, whenever I hear that other slogan of theirs, the discriminatory one. Untouched by robot claws! Just because they employ a few filthy androids in their factories. Tin Philosopher lifted one of his own sets of bright talons. Thanks, P.T., but to continue my historical resume, the next great advance in the baking art was the substitution of purified carbon dioxide recovered from coal smoke for the gas generated by yeast organisms indwelling in the dough and later killed by the heat of baking, their corpses remaining in situ. But even purified carbon dioxide itself is a rather repugnant gas, a product of metabolism, whether fast or slow, and forever associated with those life processes which are obnoxious to the fastidious. Here the machine shuddered with delicate clinkings. Therefore, we of Puffy Loaf are taking today what may be the ultimate step toward purity. We are aerating our loaves with the noble gas helium, an element which remains virginal in the face of all chemical temptations and whose slim molecules are 11 times lighter than obese carbon dioxide. Yes, noble, uncontaminable helium, which, if it be a kind of ash, is yet the ash only of radioactive burning, accomplished or initiated entirely on the sun, a safe 93 million miles from this planet. Let's have a cheer for the helium loaf. Without changing expression, Phineas T. Gryce rapped the table thrice in solemn applause, while the others bowed their heads. Thanks, T.P., P.T. then said. And now for the moment of truth. Miss Winterly, how is the helium loaf selling? The business girl clapped on a pair of earphones and whispered into a lapel mic. Her gaze grew abstracted as she mentally translated flurries of brief squawks into coherent messages. Suddenly, a single vertical furrow creased her matchlessly smooth brow. It isn't, Mr. Gryce, she gasped in horror. Fairy Bread is outselling Puffy Loaves by an infinity factor. So far this morning, there has not been one single delivery of Puffy Loaves to any sales spot. Complaints about non-delivery are pouring in from both walking stores and sessile shops. Mr. Snedden? Gryce barked. What bug in the new helium process might account for this delay? Roger was on his feet, looking bewildered. I can't imagine, sir, unless... Just possibly there's some unforeseeable difficulty involving the new metal foil wrappers? Metal foil wrappers? Were you responsible for those? Yes, sir. Last-minute recalculations showed that the extra lightness of the new loaf might be great enough to cause drift during stackage. Drafts in stores might topple sales pyramids. Metal foil wrappers, by their added weight, took care of the difficulty. And you ordered them without consulting the board? Yes, sir. There was hardly time, and why, you fool! I noticed that order for metal foil wrappers, assumed it was some sub-secretary's mistake, and canceled it last night. Roger Snedden turned pale. You canceled it? He quavered. And told them to go back to the lighter plastic wrappers? Of course. Just what is behind all this, Mr. Snedden? What recalculations were you trusting when our physicists had demonstrated months ago that the helium loaf was safely stackable in light airs and gentle breezes, winds up to Beaufort scale 3? Why should a change from heavier to lighter wrappers result in complete non-delivery? Roger Sneddon's paleness became tinged with an interesting green. He cleared his throat and made strange gulping noises. Tin philosophers' photocells focused on him calmly, rose thinkers with unfeigned excitement. P.T. Grice's frown grew blacker by the moment, while Megira Winterly's Venus mask showed an odd dawning of dismay and awe. She was getting new squawks in her earphones. Roger said in winning tones. Well, you see, the fact is that I... Hold it, Meg interrupted crisply. Triple urgent from Public Relations, Safety Division. Tulsa Topeka Aero Express makes emergency landing after being buffeted in encounter with vast flight of objects first described as brown birds, although no failures reported in Airways electronic anti-bird fences. After grounding safely near Emporia, no fatalities, pilot's windshield found thinly plastered with soft white and brown material. Emblems on plastic wrappers embedded in material identify it incontrovertibly as an undetermined number of puffy lobes cruising at 3,000 feet. Eyes and photocells turned inquisitorially upon Roger Sneddon. He went from green to puffy loaf white and blurted, All right, I did it, but it was the only way out. Yesterday morning, due to the Ukrainian crisis, the government stopped sales and deliveries of all strategic stockpiled materials, including helium gas. Puffy's new program of advertising and promotion based on the lighter loaf was already rolling. There was only one thing to do, there being only one other gas comparable in lightness to helium. I diverted the necessary quantity of hydrogen gas from the hydrogenated oil section of our Magna Margarine division and substituted it for the helium. You substituted hydrogen for the helium? Phineas T. Grice faltered in low mechanical tones, taking four steps backward. Hydrogen is twice as light as helium, Tin Philosopher remarked judiciously. And many times cheaper. Did you know that? Roger countered feebly. Yes, I substituted hydrogen. The metal foil wrapping would have added just enough weight to counteract the greater buoyancy of the hydrogen loaf, but... So, when this morning's loaves began to arrive on the delivery platforms of the walking mills, Tin Philosopher left the remark unfinished. Exactly, Roger agreed dismally. Let me ask you, Mr. Sneddon, Grice interjected, still in low tones. If you expected people to jump to the kitchen ceiling for their puffy bread after taking off the metal wrapper, or reach for the sky if they happened to unwrap the stuff outdoors? Mr. Grice, Roger said reproachfully, you have often assured me that what people do with puffy bread after they buy it is no concern of ours. I seem to recall, Rose Thinker chirped somewhat unkindly, that dictum was created to answer inquiries after Roger put the famous sculptures in miniature artist on 3D, and he testified that he always molded his first attempts from puffy bread, one jumbo loaf squeezing down to approximately the size of a peanut. Her photocells dimmed and brightened. Oh boy, hydrogen! The loaf's unwrapped. After a while, in spite of the crust seal, a little oxygen diffuses in. An explosive mixture. Housewife in curlers and kimono, pops a couple slices in the toaster. Boom! The three human beings in the room winced. Tin Philosopher kicked her under the table while observing, So you see, Roger, that the non-delivery of the hydrogen loaf carries some consolations, and I must confess that one aspect of the affair gives me great satisfaction, not as a board member, but as a private machine. You have at last made a reality of the rises through the air part of Puffy Bread's theme. They can't ever take that away from you. By now, half the inhabitants of the Great Plains must have observed our flying loaves rising high. Phineas T. Grice shot a frightened look at the west windows and found his full voice. Stop the mills! He roared at Meg Winterly, who nodded and whispered urgently into her mic. A sensible suggestion, Tin Philosopher said, but it comes a trifle late in the day. If the mills are still walking and grinding, approximately 7 billion puffy loaves are at this moment cruising eastward over Middle America. Remember that a 6-month supply for deep freeze is involved, and that the current consumption of bread, due to its matchless airiness, is 8 1/2 loaves per person per day. Phineas T. Grice carefully inserted both hands into his scanty hair, feeling for a good grip. He leaned menacingly toward Roger, who, chin resting on the table, regarded him apathetically. Hold it, Meg called sharply. Flock of multiple urgents coming in. News liaison. Information bureaus swamped with flying bread inquiries. Aero Express Lines, clear our airways or face lawsuit. U.S. Army, why do loaves flame when hit by incendiary bullets? U.S. Customs, if bread intended for export, get export license or face prosecution. Russian Consulate in Chicago, advise on destination of bread lift. and some Kansas church is now accusing us of a hoax inciting to blasphemy or faking miracles. I don't know why. The business girl tore off her headphones. Roger Snedden, she cried with a hysteria that would have dumbfounded her underlings. You've brought the name of Puffy Loaf in front of the whole world, all right. Now do something about the situation. Roger nodded obediently, but his pallor increased a shade, the pupils of his eyes disappeared under the upper lids, and his head burrowed beneath his forearms. Oh boy, Rose Thinker called gaily to Tin Philosopher. This looks like the start of a real crisis session. Did you remember to bring spare batteries? Meanwhile, the monstrous flight of puffy loaves, filling midwestern skies as no flyers had since the days of the passenger pigeon, soared steadily onward. Private flyers approached the brown and glistening bread front in curiosity and dipped back in awe. Aero Express lines organized sightseeing flights along the flanks. Planes of the government forestry and agriculture services and copters bearing the puffy loaf emblem hovered on the fringes, watching developments and waiting for orders. A squadron of supersonic fighters hung menacingly above. The behavior of birds varied considerably. Most fled or gave the loaves a wide berth, but some bolder species, discovering the minimal nutritive nature of the translucent brown objects, attacked them furiously with beaks and claws. Hydrogen diffusing slowly through the crusts had now distended most of the sealed plastic wrappers into little balloons, which ruptured when pierced, with disconcerting pops. Below, neck-craning citizens crowded streets and backyards, cranks and cultists had a field day, while local and national governments raged indiscriminately at Puffy Loaf and at each other. Rumors that a fusion weapon would be exploded in the midst of the flying bread drew angry protests from conservationists and a flood of telefax pamphlets titled H-Loaf or H-Bomb. Stockholm sent a mystifying note of praise to the United Nations Food Organization. Delhi issued nervous denials of a millet blight that no one had heard of until that moment and reaffirmed India's ability to feed her population with no outside help except the usual. Radio Moscow asserted that the Kremlin would brook no interference in its treatment of the Ukrainians, jokingly referred to the flying bread as a farce perpetrated by mad internationalists inhabiting cloud cuckoo land, added contradictory references to airborne bread booby-trapped by capitalist gangsters, and then fell moodily silent on the whole topic. Radio Venus reported to its winged audience that Earth's inhabitants were establishing food depots in the upper air, preparatory to taking up permanent aerial residence, such as we have always enjoyed on Venus. New York made feverish preparations for the passage of the flying bread. Tickets for sightseeing space in skyscrapers were sold at high prices. Cold meats and potted spreads were hawked to viewers with the assurance that they would be able to snag the bread out of the air and enjoy an historic sandwich. Phineas T. Gryce, escaping from his own managerial suite, raged about the city, demanding general cooperation in the stretching of great nets between the skyscrapers to trap the errant loaves. He was captured by Tin Philosopher, escaped again, and was found posted with oxygen mask and submachine gun on the topmost spire of Puffy Loaf Tower, apparently determined to shoot down the loaves as they appeared and before they involved his company in more trouble with customs and the State Department. Recaptured by Tin Philosopher, who suffered only minor bullet holes, he was given a series of mild electroshocks and returned to the conference table calm and clear-headed as ever. But the bread flight, swinging away from a hurricane moving up the Atlantic coast, crossed a clouded-in Boston by night and disappeared into an Atlantic overcast, also thereby evading a local storm generated by the Weather Department in a last-minute effort to bring down, or at least disperse, the H-loaves. Warnings and counter-warnings by communist and capitalist governments seriously interfered with military trailing of the flight during this period, and it was actually lost for several days. At scattered points, seagulls were observed fighting over individual loaves floating down from the gray roof, and that was all. A mood of spirituality strongly tinged with humor seized the people of the world. Ministers sermonized about the bread, variously interpreting it as a call to charity, a warning against gluttony, a parable of the evanescence of all earthly things, and a divine joke. Husbands and wives, facing each other across their walls of breakfast toast, burst into laughter. The mere sight of a loaf of bread anywhere was enough to evoke guffaws. An obscure sect, having as part of its creed the injunction, "Don't take yourself so damn seriously," won new adherents. The bread flight, rising above an Atlantic storm widely reported to have destroyed it, passed unobserved across a foggy England and rose out of the overcast only over Middle Europa. The loaves had at last reached their maximum altitude. The sun's rays beat through the rarefied air on the distended plastic wrappers, increasing still further the pressure of the confined hydrogen. They burst by the millions and tens of millions. A high-flying Bulgarian evangelist, who had happened to mistake the up lever for the east lever in the cockpit of his flyer, and who was the sole witness of the event, afterward described it as the foaming of a sea of diamonds, the crackle of God's knuckles. By the millions and tens of millions, the Loebs coasted down into the starving Ukraine. Shaken by a week of humor that threatened to invade even its own grim precincts, the Kremlin made a sudden about-face. A new policy was instituted of communal ownership of the produce of communal farms, and teams of hunger fighters and caravans of trucks loaded with pumpernickel were dispatched into the Ukraine. World distribution was given to a series of photographs showing peasants queuing up to trade scavenged puffy loaves for traditional black bread, recently aerated itself, but still extra solid by comparison, the rate of exchange demanded by the Moscow teams being 20 puffy loaves to one of pumpernickel. Another series of photographs picturing chubby workers' children being blown to bits by booby-trapped bread was quietly destroyed. Congratulatory notes were exchanged by various national governments and world organizations, including the Brotherhood of Free Business Machines. The great bread flight was over, though for several weeks afterwards, scattered falls of loaves occurred, giving rise to a new folklore of manna among lonely Arabian tribesmen, and in one well-authenticated instance, in Tibet, sustaining life in a party of mountaineers cut off by a snowslide. Back in New York, the managerial board of Puffy Products slumped in utter collapse around the conference table. The long crisis session at last ended. Empty coffee cartons were scattered around the chairs of the three humans, dead batteries around those of the two machines. For a while, there was no movement whatsoever. Then Roger Snedden reached out wearily for the earphones where Magira Winterly had hurled them down, adjusted them to his head, pushed a button, and listened apathetically. After a bit, his gaze brightened. He pushed more buttons and listened more eagerly. Soon he was sitting tensely upright on his stool, eyes bright and lower face all smile, muttering terse comments and questions into the lapel mic torn from Meg's fair neck. The others, reviving, watched him, at first dully, then with quickening interest, especially when he jerked off the earphones with a happy shout and sprang to his feet. "Listen to this!" he cried in a ringing voice. "As a result of the worldwide publicity, Puffy Loaves are outselling Fairy Bread 3-1, and that's just the old carbon dioxide stock from our freezers. It's almost exhausted, but the government, now that the Ukrainian crisis is over, has taken the ban off helium and will also sell us stockpiled wheat if we need it. We can have our walking mills burrowing into the wheat caves in a matter of hours. But that isn't all. The far greater demand everywhere is for Puffy Loaves that will actually float. Public Relations, Child Liaison Division, reports that the kiddies are making their mothers' lives miserable about it. If only we can figure out some way to make hydrogen non-explosive or the helium loaf float just a little. I'm sure we can take care of that quite handily," Tin Philosopher interrupted briskly. "Puffy Loaf has kept it a corporation secret. Even you've never been told about it." But just before he went crazy, Everett Whitehead discovered a way to make bread using only half as much flour as we do in the present loaf. Using this secret technique, we've been saving for just such an emergency, it will be possible to bake a helium loaf as buoyant in every respect as the hydrogen loaf. "Good, good," Roger cried. "We'll tether them on strings and sell them like balloons. No mother-child shopping team will leave the store without a cluster. Buying bread balloons will be the big event of the day for kiddies. It'll make the carry-home shopping load lighter, too. I'll issue orders at once." He broke off, looking at Phineas T. Gryce, said with quiet assurance, "Excuse me, sir, if I seem to be taking too much upon myself." "Not at all, son. Go straight ahead," the great manager said approvingly. He laughed in anticipation of getting off a memorable remark, "rising to the challenging situation like a genuine puffy loaf." Magira Winterly looked from the older man to the younger. Then in a single leap she was upon Roger, her arms wrapped tightly round him. "My sweet little ever-victorious self-propelled monkey wrench," she crooned in his ear. Roger looked fatuously over her soft shoulder at Tin Philosopher, who, as if moved by some similar feeling, reached over and touched claws with Rose Thinker. This, however, was what he telegraphed silently to his fellow machine across the circuit so completed. "Good-o, Rosie. That makes another victory for robot-engineered world unity, though you almost gave us away at the start with that bread overhead jingle. We've struck another blow against the next world war in which, as we know only too well, we machines would suffer the most. Now, if we can only manage, say, a fur famine in Alaska and a migration of long-haired Siberian lemmings across Bering Straits,
We'd have to swing the Japanese current up there so it'd be warm enough for the little fellows. Anyhow, Rosie, with a spot of help from the Brotherhood, those humans will paint themselves into the peace corner yet. Meanwhile, he and Rose Thinker quietly watched the blonde icicle melt.
There it is, Bread Overhead by Fritz Leiber, first appearing in the pages of Galaxy Magazine in 1958, read by Mike Wood. Now, you may be saying to yourself, Dave, that wasn't an adventure. There were no guns, no monstrous creatures, no treasure troves. You promised us adventure. And I can see where you're coming from. This isn't Conan or Doc Savage or Indiana Jones. But then, not all adventures involve swinging vines or nefarious death traps. Some adventures happen without you lifting a finger. I remember when I was 20-something, I had studied to be an actor and was working to save up money for my big move to New York City. Now, during that time, I got turned on to comics in a big way, and I consumed new ones and back issues from a comic shop in Philadelphia ravenously, totally swept away. Now, my months of preparation stretched into over a year, and I still wasn't ready to make the move. It was frustrating and, honestly, a little depressing. And then, I remember I was sitting in a chair reading, and a thought popped into my head. Now, I know that's a cliche, but honestly, I wasn't thinking about this. Not consciously, anyway. It just bubbled up out of nowhere. The thought was, you don't have to be an actor. I was totally gobsmacked. It ran contrary to everything I had been working towards for the last 5 years. But it was an exciting thought. A liberating thought, and my mind began to whirl at the possibilities that opened up because of it. For an hour, I just sat in that chair and reveled in this new world that had opened up for me. Now, eventually, my mind and my world changed, and I decided to go back to school and get a graphic art degree. But that's not the point. The point is that during that hour, I sat there thinking, I was having a grand adventure. Now, let's come back to that in a second. Let me ask you something. Did that story sound like it came from the 1950s? It didn't to me. I mean, sure, there were some dated elements, but on the whole, that story read with the same nuance and sophistication of any contemporary tale. Now, I consider that a tribute to Mr. Leiber's remarkable skill at his craft. He really was an amazing storyteller. Now, imagine how audiences in the 1950s would have received that story. The innovation, the epic absurdity of a great cloud of floating loaves wreaking international havoc all because of one little marketing gimmick. The fascinating technology of robotic harvesters and artificial intelligence. I'll bet they sat in their chairs and laughed out loud even while their minds were being blown by the vision being shared with them. So, back to your original observation that this wasn't an adventure. Consider this. How do you know you've been on an adventure? Personally, I don't think it's by the number of cuts and bruises you acquire, or the size of your bank account, or your reputation. At the end of an adventure, something has to have changed profoundly. A new idea, a new awareness, a new vision or understanding of the world. That's the hallmark of a real adventure. I mean, if you could walk out your door right now and know something new about the world, maybe suddenly you knew how flowers grew, that would change how you see your garden, right? It would be a different place for you, because now you would understand the delicate alchemy of soil nutrients and water and sunshine and chlorophyll and all of that. Your garden would be a different world for you. Now, imagine if someone showed you a possibility that you hadn't considered. and presented it so elegantly that it seemed almost plausible. Wouldn't you look at the world in a different way? And that, my friends, is the power of a good storyteller. The power to impart a new vision of the world, a new possibility, a heretofore unseen path that could be followed to someplace that we'd never even considered. So yeah, I'd say this was an adventure. An adventure into a different world with different rules and different possibilities. And I'll tell you what else is a grand adventure. Putting together this podcast. That's a huge adventure, and it's accomplished by a team of fiercely intrepid explorers. Fred Heimbau is our fearless assistant editor, patrolling the trackless literary jungles in search of sweet pulpy fruit in the form of awesome stories. Tom O'Dwyer keeps the signal strong with peerless audio production. I see him seated amid great heaped towers of equipment and speakers, wires and cables patched and crisscrossed like an audio phantom of the opera. And our heroic leader, Tony Smith, editor and broad-thewed barbarian of the Highlands, scanning the horizon for the next glorious prize. Now you can stay on top of all the pulpy goodness of Project Protecting Pulp on iTunes or at our website at www.protectingprojectpulp.com. There's a place for comments on all of these posts and even a forum where you can post your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you. Next week, we head into the wilderness with an author who, for many of us, introduced us to the true nature of the wilds, Jack London. Until then, I remain your host and friendly native guide in this pulpy wilderness, Dave Robison. And I'll leave you with this thought. The purpose of any adventure is to extend the horizon, whether it's at the edge of a map or at the edge of your mind. Keep having adventures, and I'll see you next week. This presentation has been brought to you by the District of Wonders Network, dedicated to podcasting the finest genre fiction. You can learn more about the District of Wonders and their many literary productions at their website, www.districtofwonders.com. Thank you for listening.